Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm Dave Speck and joining me is the usual gang. We've got reporter John Roberts. Hiya, John.
Hi there, Dave.
We've got deputy news editor Mary Louise Clues. Hi, Mary Louise.
Hi there.
We've got reporter Catherine Love. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Now, coming up, why teachers need clarity by the end of this term on how exams are going to work next year. And we've also got the pupil craze, which is costing schools thousands of pounds in damaged plastic chairs. But first, Education Secretary Gavin Williamson has made announcements aimed at getting more schools to become academies. These were made in his speech to the Confederation of Schools Trusts the Confederation of School Trusts Conference. John, help me out here. You were covering this. Are we likely to see all schools becoming academies at some point in the near future?
That's his ambition. He said that he wanted to move from having 50% of pupils educated in schools and academy trusts to 100%. And it's not just that he wants all schools to be academies. He wants all schools to be in multi-academy trusts.
Yes, yeah.
So there's also been encouragement for single academy trusts who converted under the government's academies program to join a MAT. And he's announced several ways in which he wants to do this. One thing that was trailed before his speech was what they're calling a try before you buy, whereby a MAT a school can form a kind of a temporary partnership with a multi-academy trust and kind of get a feel for what it would be like to be part of that.
Which is already happening, isn't it, in some parts of the world?
It happens. I mean, I think they're very much just trying to roll out something that is happening naturally in the sector anyway, absolutely. They're just trying to kind of build a framework around it. I think the language of try before you buy is quite interesting because in a way, it's the MAT that acquires the school rather than the school that acquires the MAT, if you know what I mean. The school becomes part of the multi-academy trust. Try before you sell might be a more accurate description of it. But that's been reasonably well received by the sector, I think. I think that's seen as sensibly kind of trying to roll out something that, as you say, is happening organically anyway. They also announced plans for more church academy trusts and a turnaround trust for struggling Catholic schools and more money to support MATs to grow. But perhaps the most contentious bit of the announcement was he said that he's looking at ways of triggering academisation or moving schools into MATs if they get three requires improvement Ofsted judgments in a row.
Yeah, it's like three strikes and you're in, isn't it?
I think that's a really interesting announcement because it was a vague announcement. It didn't sort of say, "This is how we're going to do it." It's very much an aspiration, so we're not clear whether they're talking about forced academisation or whether they try and pour lots of support in to move you into a MAT. But it does change the nature of that Ofsted judgment. At the moment, an inadequate judgment can trigger an academy order. But this basically means if you get three requires improvements, you're kind of potentially, because we don't know exactly how the DfE are going to do it, you'd be in scope for academisation. And I just think going back a bit, a grade three used to be called a satisfactory, so things were fine.
Yeah.
And it became requires improvement. And now it's requires improvement. And if you keep getting it, the government thinks they need to kind of intervene. So I think that might be the most contentious bit because it kind of makes Ofsted inspections a bit more high stakes. And it was interesting that Askell, will have a lot of academy leaders and MAT leaders in their membership, were quite critical of the focus on this.
Yeah, they called it an obsession, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think the two things that kind of stood out from their statement, one is that the sector has got a lot on its plate dealing with the kind of the fallout and the ongoing challenges posed by COVID. So for him to be sort of, in their words, and fixating on academy structures, I think to them seems like the wrong priority. And the other bit was that Jeff Barton said that if you kind of make requires improvement or regular requires improvement a threshold for academies, you risk further stigmatising schools and it'll be a lot more schools as well. It's clear that Gavin Williamson has kind of signed up to the agenda that some in the sector have, that we should... At the moment, the system is kind of pick and mix, as he describes it. There's a variety of different schools and different structures, and it would be cleaner and more straightforward and logical if everyone was in the same support structure. That's something we've had indications that was what he wanted before, but he's really sort of nailed his colours to that mast this week.
We had Leora Crudders, who's the chief exec of the CST. She made some comments following these announcements, and she just sort of spoke up the benefits about academies, and she said, you know, that they create the conditions for better collaboration and they improve the quality of education, And then she said there's a power in groups of schools working together in a single accountability structure. And I mean, it's obviously clearly there's a huge support for academies in this sort of model, isn't there, John? And I mean,
yeah, and I mean, she's a very influential voice in the sector, but it's very much what they've been campaigning for. So they are not just Academy Trust, but Confederation of School Trusts. They believe in the kind of the model of MATS.
Yeah.
And they put something out this week basically saying that they've had some research done that basically said during the COVID pandemic, they feel that the MATS structure has been shown to be beneficial. Like schools have been able to pull on resources for HR or curriculum, or MATS have been able to pour in funds to remote learning devices and this sort of thing. So they feel like during the challenge of a pandemic, that schools inside a strong MAT were better placed than a single standalone school. So they've obviously welcomed it because it's very much what they've been advocating for some time.
Yeah, yeah. I just remember I was tuning into the other major conference this week, the Schools and Academies show, and there was chief exec of a MAT in one of the panels there, and she was talking about how she'd not only collaborated within her own MAT, but she'd helped out schools that were not part of MATs, that they were in the maintained sector, that just weren't getting any support from the local authority about this constantly changing guidance from the DfE. And she said, you know, I had quite a few heads ringing me up and sort of asking for advice. And then she sort of made this other point that, you know, MATs should be judged on their collaboration and how they collaborate with other schools as part of their Ofsted, the Ofsted framework. But I tell you what, Mary Louise, the MAT model isn't the only model, is it? And there's no kind of silver bullet, no magic bullet for this, is there, for school success, according to our Chief Inspector of Schools. Is that right?
Absolutely. That was the same conference that Confederation of Schools Trust, Amanda Spillman, was talking this morning. And she addressed this major policy speech from the Education Secretary. And she had a lot of good things to say about MATS and about academies.
Yes, she did.
But she said, you know, of course they work, they can provide resilience against failure. They're encouraging science, but she said it's important that Ofsted remain structure agnostic, was the term she used. And she also went on to say, look, no structure is perfect, and there isn't a single magic bullet that is going to improve schools when you're looking at structure. The most important thing is to look at the quality of education that they're providing. And the sort of however they're organised comes after that. So that was interesting from Amanda, but I guess reassuring as well for some.
One other quick thing I'd say is just that it'd be interesting to see how they do it, because in a way, when Michael Gove first brought academies in and there was a real rush for change to grow, you went from having effective academy, like a single school that was very good, became an effective small academy trust, then rapidly expanded and got into difficulty. And one of the problems is building capacity. There's an enormous number of schools that aren't academies, and it can't be done overnight. And part of me thinks if this was a kind of a natural thing, it would be happening naturally. I just wonder whether we've reached a kind of a capacity threshold. And it's the reason it's not happening more is because the trusts just aren't there with the capacity to take on more schools. And if the government try and force it, we might see what we saw a few years ago, which is small MATs become very big MATs and then start to have problems because they're not able to support schools across their network.
She did say, despite the many benefits of being part of a trust, we know that things can and sometimes do go wrong. So she is sort of being very clear and saying, you know, well, like you say, there's no magic bullet. What you were saying, John, about MAT capacity and whether we've reached a kind of natural point in terms of saturation of MATs and their ability to take on other schools, is that the only factor, or is it, you know, sort of pockets of resistance and kind of public opposition?
I think there's a bit of that. And there's also, there's issues with geographic spread as well. So there'll be some parts of the country where, and there's particularly been a concern across parts of the north, where there isn't the capacity. So there's schools in remote areas where there just isn't a natural trust to take them on. And we've written in the past about some, what's become known as orphan schools, which is schools that have kind of met the threshold to become an academy, but a home can't be found for them. So the government's trying various different levers to try and get mats to grow. But I just think it'll probably have to be done carefully, because when they had rapid expansion of academy growth in the past, it sometimes worked, but it definitely sometimes doesn't.
It's interesting, isn't it, when people say that, you know, mats are standing together in one accountability structure. Well, accountable to who? Because, and this is one of the things that some of the unions have said, isn't it, that there is no democratic accountability. I mean, when a school performs badly and it's part of a local authority, that is the portfolio holder or the council who's in charge of education is answerable to the electorate. You've got this sort of leverage there, haven't you? The director of children's services, say, in a local authority who is in charge of schools, like, say, the MAT CEO, he is answerable to the councillor who is elected, you know, on the success of schools. And all that's kind of gone, isn't it? So when you've got people in the MAT sector talking about accountability, what do you think that means, John? I mean,
it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that question is probably at the heart of the academy's debate, really. To what extent does growing MATs change the relationship between the public and schools? You know, would a parent understand if you're part of a national MAT where the decision maker lies and that effectively the governing body at school level isn't the decision making body? It's everything sits at the central trust. And I think advocates would say, yeah, but we've demonstrated that this is successful. But you're right, there is a question about whether there's a democratic deficit. And in terms of accountability, the other thing I'll say very quickly, I know I've been rabbiting on about this a lot, is Ofsted don't inspect MATs. You know, if Gavin Williamson is saying MATs are the bottom brick, the kind of the fabric of the school system, Ofsted has no remit to judge them. They've done various things to try and look at them, and they've done batch inspections when they then produce a report kind of making some conclusions about a MAT. But fundamentally, if MATs are the kind of the core component of the school structure, will we see Ofsted inspecting them? I don't get the sense there's any political appetite for that from within the government. But you might say, well, if you're making them, if they are what you think is the key to school improvement, the key to successful schools, surely they should be subject to the same kind of scrutiny that education authorities used to be when they were responsible for all schools.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm sure we could talk a bit more about this. But anyway, let's move on, because Catherine, you're of course with us, our GCSE expert. And something else that was said at the CST conference this week, and it was I think it was a keynote speech by the chair of exam regulator Ofqual, Ian Baucom, and he made some interesting comments on GCSEs, didn't he, Catherine? Something about teachers mustn't let their sympathies sway their judgments when awarding grades. And can I ask, what did he say would be the consequences of grades, say, not telling the truth about a pupil's abilities?
So he sort of raised like a number of concerns, really. If grades are awarded, I suppose, too generously. And I think, you know, one of the concerns was that when students go on to the next stage of their education or in training, if they have been awarded a grade which doesn't really reflect what they can do and what they know, that's going to leave that student in a difficult position, and they might struggle in their course and possibly drop out.
So in other words, a teacher might think, well, I'm kind of being sympathetic, but actually it could backfire on that pupil's kind of chances in life, to quote the worst case scenario.
Yeah, so that was one concern was about what happens next if students get grades that don't necessarily reflect where they are. And the other concern he raised was, you know, it would obviously damage the kind of validity of qualifications, and for other students, it might also sort of damage their own hard-won qualifications and hard work going towards a particular grade. So he essentially was sort of really pointing out the dangers of doing that, and kind of saying he did sort of say, you know, it's very hard to do. I think teachers have been set a really difficult task this year, and possibly a more difficult task than last year in many ways, because, you know, they've got to put together evidence towards the grades that they're assigning, and it's a more complex process than than was the one that was used last year. So I think he acknowledged this is really difficult. But don't let your sympathies kind of sway you when you are awarding marks.
Because I know over at the other conference, the Schools and Academies show, there was the Colin Hughes, who's the head of the largest exam board, the AQA. He was shedding light on the possible future of GCSEs, wasn't he? What does it look like? How do GCSEs look next year and in 2023, would you say?
I would say that everyone in the sector is kind of, you know, holding their cards pretty close to their chest and is not really saying anything yet. And I think Simon Leibus also said this morning at the Schools and Academies show, when asked about sort of grading standards next year and the year after, and whether the 2019 GCSE and A-level grades grading standards will ever be applied again. And he sort of said, you know, we need to see what happens this summer, and a lot of thought will need to be put into how we reintroduce exams and how we reintroduce the grading standards from before. And I think that has been a kind of a general theme with people in the sector talking about 2022, 2023. So Colin Hughes said, it can't be a leap back to normality, and it may not happen in 2022 or 2023, and that, you know, we're really going to need to think carefully about how we reintroduce these exams. And similarly, you know, we've had Simon Leibus talking about the fact that the exams next year may not be the term he used was kind of full fat exams, as we spoke about last week. So, you know, the fact that there might be some learning aids in there next year. And the other thing that everyone has raised is the fact that as well as the GCSEs next year, the A-level cohort won't have sat any kind of form of public examination. So you're also looking at quite a different picture. At A-level, you're looking at a year 13 cohort who have lost kind of a significant chunk of their education, and also haven't had that experience of sitting GCSEs. So I would say there are no definitive answers at the moment about what happens next year, which is interesting because I'm sure, as we're going to go on to talk about, the NAHT has said that they need answers.
I was just going to say, just before we do move on to that, well, I guess it's related, but Catherine, but you mentioned Simon Leibus speaking this morning. We've got a story up on our site, and I didn't hear him speaking. You did, so I might have got the wrong impression. But from what he was saying, he seemed to be sort of issuing a kind of plea to the profession, didn't he, to teachers and schools, and saying, "I know that there's going to be this burden of admin. I know that there's been a kind of strong reaction against that, but you know, but we really need to work together to kind of provide quality assurance. We can't have a return to the febrile atmosphere that we had, or a repeat of that in 2020. And he sort of talked about how everyone in the exam board sort of sector and involved in exams just had a massive hit on their morale last year, seeing all the headlines about chaos and lack of trust. And just said, look, we're doing our best. We're only human. But I just wondered whether teachers are concerned at that kind of impact on morale. You know, we don't know what's going to happen this year. Whether that's going to shift from people in Ofqual and people in exam boards, going to shift to kind of teachers this year, because they're going to be at the front line of that. But yeah, I just felt he was kind of saying, please just give us a break.
Absolutely. No, it's true. I think it may be passed to teachers. And I mean, in many ways, I think what he was saying was very understandable. You know, this is an imposed situation. This isn't anything that anyone would have chosen. And so, you know, that they are trying to grapple with something that with, as we say, kind of unprecedented times, and this is kind of the best case scenario. But it's I think you're right that it could be passed on to teachers. And the thing is, in 2020, obviously, you know, when the grades came out with, you know, through the algorithm, and people were unhappy with the way that 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 had been used, that we had that fallback of the central assessed grades, and then that was introduced. But this year, obviously, because the government was so burned by that algorithm, you know, we've not got that. We have just got these teacher assessed grades. So if there is kind of any significant unhappiness on results day, there won't be a fallback option. And I think that's also, you know, quite difficult. And I think the comments about, well, we'll wait to see what happens this summer are not entirely reassuring, really. I think what's really come across from the profession is that, you know, over the last 12 months, that a lot of the guidance around exams has been issued very late, and, you know, they haven't had sort of advanced sight of things to properly prepare. So I think, you know, I think NHT is right. We do need to be thinking about next year and, you know, if exams are cancelled, what the contingencies are.
It is worth mentioning the deadline that the NHT have put on this for teachers to know how exams next year will work. And that's the end of this term. By the summer is the time by which teachers need real clarity, according to the NHT. And, you know, I was at this online press conference the other day with the Paul Whiteman, the General Secretary, and a couple of the NHT Director of Policy, James Bowen, said that came up with some quite strong quotes. He said, if you're a school leader or a teacher, you need to start the next academic year with your pupils knowing exactly how the exams and assessments are going to work. And that means having a plan A. He said, if that means having a plan A and a plan B, great. But we need to know now. So if there is going to be this idea of, say, optionality, then, you know, we need to know that ahead of September. He said, we can't have teachers spending the first term teaching and going through content only to find out that exams are going to be slightly different. It's a waste of time, isn't it? And it's just this lack of certainty, not just for teachers, but for pupils as well. I think it'd be interesting to see if the DfE can really nail this by sort of the certainly before teachers break up for the summer and give them plenty of notice and warning. Seems like the fair thing to do, doesn't it? And it, I mean, we've had all this kind of sort of debate in the last couple of years already. So that this kind of the route to doing this should already be kind of there, shouldn't it? That the if that makes any sense.
I mean, I think it's from kind of sort of conversations I've had so far about next year. I think that there's definitely, you know, a strong sense of, we want exams to happen. We want to go back to exams from government. And the only thing I'd say with that, I mean, in some ways, you know, obviously, I think, you know, there are a lot of students and teachers who'd like to see formal exams back. They do have that sense of validity. I think the only thing with that is obviously that was also what happened this year, where sort of the government's very clear, no, exams are going ahead, exams are going ahead. And then in January, they were cancelled. And I mean, obviously, at the moment, it really depends what happens with the pandemic. But, you know, I think they do have to think about, well, what happens if there's another wave? What
Indeed.
Happens if they have to be cancelled? There has
plan
to be some
needed.
Sort of plan.
Yeah. Well, look, John, can I just, well, I know we're running out of time now, but you've got this exclusive interview with the General Secretary of the NHT Heads Union, Paul Whiteman, today. And he paints quite a bleak picture about the fact that schools are having to lose people who should be in the front line when it comes to helping children catch up. Can you just sort of talk us through this, John, if you wouldn't mind, just briefly, because...
Sure. So, the thing that came across from this interview with him, I suppose he basically talked about the consequences of schools losing staff in terms of the recovery effort. And we're waiting to see the big recovery plan that's expected soon. But I think the point he's making is that the bottom brick of the recovery effort has got to be schools functioning well. And he pointed to two reasons why that there's going to be problems. The first is, he says that there's increases in school funding that were announced a couple of years ago and are starting to come into the system are being offset by the increased cost of COVID.
And he's talking about the 7 billion, isn't he? This 7 billion, this pre-election pledge.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's been swallowed up now, isn't it?
That's what they're saying, that the initial wave of it is not making a difference because of the additional costs of COVID, the lost income through COVID. And he was talking about speaking to school leaders who are making difficult decisions on redundancies now. And he's basically saying, you know, if we're talking about catch-up being the national priority, and yet the people who are charged, you know, tasked with educating children are having to reduce their workforce now, and that can't be right. And then the other thing, which you kind of know about, but he put it in this light of what it will mean for the recovery effort, is that the union is inundated with members, the school leaders union, asking about early retirement. And he said that he thought the expectation is that the people are committed to seeing their schools through the pandemic, but the burden of it and the amount of extra work and everything that they've had to go through means that once they feel that we're past the worst of the crisis, that they will want to call it a day. And he says we could be hit. I think we had a story a while back saying 47% were thinking about it. And he said this isn't just an expression of exasperation. They're now seeing that in calls to their helpline. And if that happens, you know, even if half or a third of that number follow through on that, you're seeing a massive loss of leadership and expertise and knowledge right at the time when
absolutely
we're kind of expecting schools to be at the forefront. And I think the other point that kind of, perhaps I didn't make it explicitly clear, but it certainly got me thinking about it, is we talk about all these added on extras for recovery, but really recovery, like the most important aspect of it, is just children's day-to-day schooling. That is the bit that's going to sort of define where their education is. And if schools are having to lose staff because of kind of knock-on effects of funding and COVID pressures, then that's going to undermine the effort to kind of make up for the lost learning in the pandemic.
Well, look, shall we wrap up then? And I think we've just got a minute left to talk about this this astonishing craze in which pupils are using face mask string to destroy plastic chairs. Seems absurd to talk about this in the context of what we've just been talking about. But I mean, the kind of you were quite shocked by this, Mary Louise, weren't you? This story, which is on our website, and we've got a YouTube video made by a pupil demonstrating this. But it seems a lot of schools are suffering this, and I think that's why we've covered it.
I haven't actually watched the video yet, but I just found it amazing that you could saw a chair in half with some string, but apparently you can.
There's one as well that's kind of going into a wooden desk as well, and kind of it's quite astonishing.
It is, and it just struck me that if that energy could be channeled somehow by teachers into something else.
Design and technology. Surely.
If it was in the right lesson, it might be appropriate. But anyway, listen, we'll leave it there. Thanks for listening and see you soon. Bye.
Yes. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.